With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
You're listening to Text Message, the UK-focused technology podcast with me, Nate Langson.
And me, Ian Morris.
Happy New Year, my friend.
Oh, thank you. Happy New Year to you too. Let's hope it's better than the last one.
It's been a trying year, let's say that. It's been difficult. It's been crap. Let's descend into depravity. It's been crap. That's how the year has been. But this is a new year, and to start the new year with this somewhat special episode of Text Message, we're joined by special guest from CNET.com, Mr. Andrew Hoyle.
Hello there.
Who is absolutely not 3 feet away from me in real life. Andy, in two words, can you sum up last year, please?
Basically lame.
Did you have a nice happy new year, though?
I had a wonderful new year, thank you. Yes, did you both?
Yeah, it was all right. I mean, I stayed in and sort of didn't do anything except play a video game.
Well, we hope from here, from our aortic pumps, our hearts, at Text Message, that this year is significantly better than the last. And we're going to start off by looking at some positive things that happened in the technology world over the last 12 months. Things that, stories that we talked about that made us very excited, that took our hearts and warmed them to a few degrees extra on that day. And we want to see from these stories if we can be more hopeful about what they will mean for 2017. And we've got some great stories that we've discussed throughout the year to get to again here on this show. And I'm going to start by talking about ad blocking. Now, one thing that we did talk about in quite a lot of detail last year was mobile phone companies. And Three was one such company that tried to implement ad blocking at the network level. It did this in February. In fact, it didn't. We started talking about it in February on episode 48. And they ran a trial and they decided that the trial was actually quite successful, but they are not going to implement ad blocking next year. Ian, what do you think of ad blocking?
I think that it's fine when a consumer decides to do it themselves. I think that's everyone's right, although I don't agree with it because obviously we have to pay our bills somehow. But at the same time, I don't see that there's any reason that a network provider would have any reason to block ads on anyone's behalf. I just don't think that's acceptable.
Well, I missed the story originally in November from Marketing Week that had said that Three was moving away from ad blocking after it, quote, pissed Google off and, quote, received threats from brands for its approach to mobile advertising. Tom,
I mean, that's not a surprise, is it?
No. Tom Malaschitz, or Malaschitz, I'm not quite sure how to pronounce his name, but he's a chief marketing officer at Three, was speaking at an event in November in London and said that the ad blocking tests were very successful. About 86% of customers said they were satisfied, but it's not the solution to the mobile ad problem. So it seems that the trial that we were quite critical of this year is not going to translate next year into a full-blown ad blocking mobile approach. Andy, what's your final thought on this?
I think that is good. I don't think ad blocking is the right solution. I agree that a lot of ads, particularly mobile ads, when it takes your data, they are quite intrusive and they're basically a pain in the ass, but simply blocking them isn't the solution at all there, because as you say, that's how companies make their money.
Yeah. And I think that really the solution is better ads. And that's one of the things that Three has learnt. So my hope is that maybe in 2017, with mobile networks thinking about what could make a better ad on their platform and maybe promoting the usage of whatever better approach they come up with, we could at least maybe see a small change in the mobile advertising experience in 2017, Ian, would you say that's...
Yeah, I mean, exactly. I think that, you know, we're getting faster and faster speeds. 4G's picking up. I noticed that Qualcomm's leaked that it's got its first gigabit LTE modem and going into phones this year. So, yeah, I mean, everything's going to get better on mobile. And, I mean, I'm sure we can work our way around the ad blocking, you know, and big malicious ads problem.
Well, to story two that we came to this year, this is something we first talked about in July in episode 66. Amazon got permission to test delivery drones in the UK's skies. And This is something they are pioneering out of Cambridge. The research lab for Amazon Prime Air is in Cambridge, and they've done at least one public relations stunt in December to show a delivery getting to a real customer, though conveniently placed cameras at the customer's house suggests that was very much prepped as a bit of a stunt, so we didn't bother talking about that. But the fact is, there's a lot of money and effort and time and smart minds thinking about this problem and going into solving this problem. And the question is it a problem that it currently takes a whole day to get a delivery?
A whole day.
I see this as a step forward in things like medical use. I think delivering same day or within minutes, organs, blood across cities like London, where there's so much traffic that getting organs within minutes from one hospital to another is extremely difficult. So I think drones for that sort of thing is great, and certainly the money being spent by companies like Amazon is going to help fund research into these drones for medical use.
How many people do you think are going to order a new heart on Amazon Prime?
Well, the wrong sort of people.
By one for sale, used.
Once Amazon has made this technology really workable, then that's when other firms, and particularly companies like the NHS and stuff, could start picking this up and using it for genuine applications. Certainly in the short term, does it mean that you can order a new CD and have it within the hour? Yeah, great, fair enough, but it's not really a massive step forward for the consumer, is it? Well, you can already get it next day.
I note with interest that Amazon has also now got a patent on airships, which it proposes will be the launch platform for drones. So basically, certain select items will be stocked in airship warehouses. And this sounds like a load of nonsense, but I'm assured that serious publications have written this up. And these airships will launch drones, which will descend to houses and deliver products. I remain somewhat sceptical about it, but at the same time, I can see there's a lot of real advantages to getting delivery drivers and delivery trucks off the roads. It's, we can free up some traffic, we can reduce emissions. It'd be a really good idea. So if they can do it, yeah, great.
Can I just check, Ian? Do you mean that the plan would be that there's going to be a massive Amazon warehouse permanently hovering in the sky, and then when someone orders something, it just drops down via drone to their house?
That is basically the idea. I suspect what will probably happen is that the airships will they will have a schedule, I guess. And so Amazon will they'll be able to say to you, well, all right, the airship will be near you for this time. I have no idea. The whole thing is ridiculous.
I think the more realistic way of this working is that Amazon knows what sort of products get ordered in what sort of vicinity at what sort of time of year. And so, for example, if there is something like the Olympics on and people are ordering SD cards and batteries for their camera, then maybe that type of product could be hovered locally to that area. Maybe it's around events, and that's something they could do.
I suspect that groceries might form a part of this. Things like, I need toilet rolls and I'm on the toilet right now, please send. Do you want a bit of Amazon trivia as well about this year, 2017? It's the year its one-click patent expires.
Wow. What does that mean?
Yeah, so it will no longer work. It will mean that it will no longer be able to say to other companies, you can't do one-click ordering.
It's the most ridiculous patent since someone tried to paint toast in the early 2000s. Patent toast.
No, it's not valid in Europe, but it is in the US, and Apple pays for it.
Well, let's stay on the topic of airships. There's a reason that these two stories are together. I invited Andy to bring us a story that he was very excited about, but didn't necessarily have to be deeply rooted in the UK. But you've come up with something that's both in the UK and global, and you're excited about it.
I am excited about this. So on the airship front, this year we saw Airlander 10 take flight. Now, Airlander 10 is the world's biggest airship, and you might have seen it in the news because, let's be honest, it looks like a giant flying buttocks. So this is a giant airship. It's the world's biggest, and it did a full flight of its airfield down somewhere in Bedfordshire, I think. The airship is it's not designed for passengers at any point. I think the idea is that this will be for cargo. So actually, this may be exactly the sort of technology that Amazon's looking into for its massive warehouses, Ian, that you're so excited about.
Yeah, I mean, that would be quite amazing, wouldn't it? I mean, if you think about it, it does sort of make a lot of sense. I mean, I guess that the Amazon's plan would be that it would restock the warehouse via drone as well. So basically, you put these things in the air and they don't need to come back down again, which means that you can make them very efficient. They can be gas filled so that you're not actually paying huge amounts of money either to have them in the air or to move them around. Hell, you could even probably solar power them.
Well, funny you should say that, Ian, because I know there's a second part to Andy's excitement with this story.
Yes, well, part two is that talking about general technology flying, this was the year where we saw the Solar Impulse plane. This is the first completely solar-powered plane do a full lap of the Earth. So that's about 40,000 kilometres this plane travelled, which I know this isn't a UK story, which is what normally you like to focus on this show, but I just thought it's so important that we're starting to look towards alternative fuels for aircraft. And in covering 40,000 kilometres, not a single fossil was burned by this plane, which I think is really quite an achievement.
Right, let's talk about broadband. It's a topic we've covered in great detail throughout this year. One of the things that rose in, I think, around the springtime, around the time of the Queen's speech, in fact, was the government, the then government, promising as part of the Digital Economy Bill, everyone in Britain getting access to at least 10 megabit per second broadband. Now, we got incredibly excited about this because this would cover millions of houses that currently can't get anywhere close to very competitive speeds of broadband, and it would allow people to start to engage with streaming video services that they can't do now, or better uploading to the cloud and usage of cloud systems and everything like that. And then we got a new government thanks to the Brexit result, and now this is kind of up in the air. And so, without wanting to put this on a downer, Ian, what is your view of how likely this 10 megabits per second for all promise might be in 2017?
Well, I mean, technically there's nothing standing in the way of it. We've got more than enough technologies around to achieve this. It's just a matter of money and making people carry out the work, isn't it, really? I mean, 10 megabits is deliverable over 4G. So in order to get that out to people, you just need to make sure you've got good 4G coverage or you pay to put cabling in. I mean, I don't think it's difficult at all. But year after year, promises have been made about a minimum service requirement, and year after year that no one has come anywhere near it in certain rural areas. And if you're in one of those areas, then, you know, you're probably getting quite cross about it by now.
Yeah, I mean, a couple of things have happened since then, and we talked about this story in detail in episode 58 in May, if anybody wants to look up sort of the nuances of this story. But we had highlighted that in 2009, Labour had then promised 2 megabits per second for every home by 2012, which obviously didn't happen, and then Cameron scrapped it, and instead they said they would deliver 24 megabits per second by 2015, which we also missed. And so now we're talking about this 10 megabits per second next year or the year after that. So there is at least a track history of this not being doable by any government. But I did notice when I was up home for Christmas in a little hamlet called Cowdale in Derbyshire that they have 4G extending out there now. And this is an area that used to barely get any phone signal at all. And at one point, I was doing another podcast, video podcast, with some other people, and had 4 simultaneous HD streams via Skype coming into my machine and my own obviously going out over 4G. It did use 9 gig of my monthly data, but it was totally possible in an area that never used to get so much as enough service to use a phone call. So I think that the wireless answer really will be the answer for this 10 megabits per second, as you say, and maybe we'll hear more of that next year as networks invest better in their infrastructure. Let's stay on the topic of phones a little bit, because I know Ian got very excited this year about thinking about the iPhone's 10th anniversary and what this might mean. This is a bit more of a global story, but it's something that Ian got excited enough about to write on Forbes. So why don't you take this one away, Ian? What happened in 2016 with phones that makes you excited about this year's phones?
Well, so basically not a lot happened with phones in 2016, which makes me think that we're due a big update. I mean, we all know that Apple wants the 10th anniversary iPhone to be something a bit special. It probably arguably needs it. It needs to get some people rebuying phones and ditching their existing handsets. And I suppose, although Samsung's not celebrating a big anniversary of the same nature, I have a feeling that this year's Note 7 debacle and the sort of, I mean, the S7 is a good phone, you know, very likable device. The S7 Edge is great. But I think that it needs to do something extra in 2017. And I wrote this up based on a relatively loose rumour. But actually, I wrote it up not because of the rumour, but because of the sort of logical sense, which is that Samsung will remove the physical buttons from its phones this year, and it may move the fingerprint scanning home button to the back of the phone, which I don't like the idea of particularly. And instead, it will have software keys, like a lot of Android phones these days do. But I think that will leave it free to have a very sort of impressive looking device with a screen that goes that's curved at the edges and extends very far up and down the device, which I think will look.
So it's kind of like a Galaxy Note Edge, but at the top and bottom rather than just the sides.
Yeah, well, no, I don't think it will be curved at the top and bottom, but I think the screen will extend to fill almost all of the phone, which will make it look very cool.
And hopefully won't explode, of course, which is one of the things that, sadly for Samsung, people will be looking at, is whether it's the Galaxy S8 or the Note 8, although I think they used to have a product called the Note 8, so they'll probably have to change the brand to separate themselves from that
actually,
product.
Actually, that is a really good point, actually. I hadn't even considered that, but I think, to be honest with you, Nate, the Note is dead. I don't think they can really bring it back now. I think they have to move on, and rumours suggest perhaps it'll just be folded in, that the Note will be a part of the S8. So there'll be maybe the S8, the S8 Edge, and an S8 Note replacement. Or they may get rid of the flat Note, the S8, and go for a curved S8 only, with the Note being the larger phone with the stylus. How that will pan out in terms of sales, I don't know. But I have a feeling that Samsung needs to, you know, really do something interesting this year.
Do you think it will do something interesting and exciting, given the Note 7 fiasco this year? Or do you think because of that and because of the money it's lost, it might try and play it safe and go a little more low-key?
I don't think so. I think Samsung's got enough money to do anything it wants to do, really. So I think the best strategy for them would be to go big and make a phone that everyone absolutely really desires, rather than just to do another phone where people are like, I don't know, I could just stick with my existing phone. You see, I've got an S6, an S6 Edge, and I love that phone. And I don't see any reason particularly to move to an S7. If other people are thinking the same as me, then they're going to see a massive drop-off in phone sales. So I would say something impressive with the S8 would be essential.
Now, there'll be a lot of attention focused on Apple, of course, because of the iPhone anniversary. There have been talks of an edge-to-edge screen, of moving to an OLED display. They've already got rid of the button on the bottom of the device on the iPhone 7, which is possibly a precursor to getting rid of it entirely and having the button integrated into the software, which is something, as a fallback, already features, I think, on the iPhone 7. If the button breaks, there's a virtual button on the screen.
It's iOS 10, I believe. It's sort of a semi-hidden, but it's an accessibility feature, in fact. You can find it under accessibility tools.
Now, it would be very easy to think that that is something they could translate into a primary feature in order to have a single, you know, edgeless design all the way around the phone. Andy, what about features you want to see in the next iPhone? What do you reckon there should be?
Okay, well, one of the things was waterproofing, but we had that in the iPhone 7. So I'm struggling to get too excited, and I kind of, what I want is a reason to be excited about phones again.
I think we're definitely going to see an OLED screen come to the iPhone probably with a curve. That's the main reason for going with an OLED, really, I would say, because Apple's screens are really good already. The only reason to go to an OLED is if there's some really tangible benefit, and curving is one of those. So perhaps we'll see a curved screen. That button, the home button, is going to go, isn't it? We're just going to have something virtual. And I suspect there were rumours about an all-glass body, weren't there? So maybe we'll see a lighter iPhone, because the metal does add a lot of weight, doesn't it?
It does. Well, you can take this opportunity to send us an email to podcast@natelangson.com and hypothesize away about anything that we've talked about so far, and we'll get to those maybe next week, particularly if you've got any views on what features should be in the next phone. That's something that we all care about. We all have a smartphone. You can let us know. podcast@natelangson.com. If you have a phone, of course, you need to connect it to a mobile network, and sometimes the networks aren't very good, or at least some networks aren't good in some areas. And one story we talked about a little more recently in October, in episode 73, was the idea put forward by government ministers to essentially kill these so-called not spots, these areas where certain networks don't have signal, by allowing users to roam onto other UK networks if their own network doesn't have service in a particular area. And the part of the argument for this is that if you're somebody overseas coming to the UK, you get to roam potentially onto several networks. So you actually get great service. And the ministers are arguing that that's meaning that we're letting foreigners come to the UK and get a better mobile phone service than we allow ourselves to have. And while I don't necessarily think this is something that's going to happen, the fact that it was discussed a lot makes me excited that next year maybe there could be some development in mobile service. Whether it's this, we don't know. But it's going to be the year that we have massive changes in roaming. If you're roaming across Europe as of, I think, the 15th of June, you will no longer be charged roaming fees at all. So at least as long as we're part of Europe, we won't be charged any roaming fees. So it's going to be a huge change. Like, roaming is going to be one of the big conversations this year, I think. And maybe that will rekindle this kind of local roaming idea again, and maybe have that as part of a mainstream conversation. Andy, what's your thought on the year of roaming?
Well, I think local roaming would be a brilliant idea. As you say, it would immediately mean that everyone has better signal, because it's basically the shared infrastructure amongst all the among all the network operators. I don't think it's going to happen, much as it should, because as you said, like, that's one of the main features that different companies sell themselves on, isn't it? EE, oh, we've got the biggest, we've got 99% coverage, or Vodafone's got however this much. So they're just not going to want to drop that, and I think that's going to be a challenge. But God, they really should do.
Ian, are you as excited as I am about the death of roaming?
I think roaming is one of the great evils of the world, because it's so difficult.
It is up there with murder, isn't it, and mass global terrorism.
I just feel that people don't. It's very difficult to ever understand what you're spending, and it's price gouging at the very best you can say about it, because basically it doesn't cost £8 a megabyte to send data back from America. It costs virtually nothing, and you know, mobile providers use it as a way to make money, and I obviously they are businesses and they are entitled to do that, but I think that they've taken it too far, and in fact I think it probably makes them less money. I think they would make more money if their international roaming fees were fairer, because you know, they would people would be more inclined to use it. We won't see global roaming reduced in the same way that we will in Europe, because obviously that requires the very special nature of Europe to happen, and that doesn't exist elsewhere. But I think
the thing to bear in mind is that this is how this often works, is that if we see Europe moving to this zero roaming model, where country to country they're having to work this out, then that's going to say a lot. That's going to at least put an idea in the minds of international operators to think, well, maybe we should have these sorts of deals. Maybe not a flat global tariff, but we're seeing it already for some networks. I mean, there are some US networks that will add inclusive roaming when they're outside of the US. We've seen networks in the UK apply that to countries like America or Hong Kong. Like, we've seen it done, just not big enough. And maybe this will be an impetus to move that forward globally.
I would say that, yeah, that could work, especially if the US operators look at Europe and think, oh, well, we could really benefit from this if we just grant Europeans access to our networks, you know, in a more inclusive rate, then we would get access to the whole of Europe for our customers. The argument will be about who travels more, I think, and I suspect that Europeans travel more to America than Americans travel to Europe, but I literally can't back that up.
One of the other stories we talked about this year, and we only talked about it very, very briefly in one episode that I couldn't even find, which was Ofcom put forward a idea that you should be able to more easily move between networks if you're disappointed with your service. So at the moment, it can be a hassle. You end up paying twice if you sign up for a new contract, if you're not at the end of your contract date. It's a real problem. And they put forward a call for responses from networks about the idea of having a more unified system of switching networks for customers. And many of the major networks didn't actually bother writing in. A few did. Three was one of the majors that did respond. I read their response, and it was they were broadly in favor of one of the methods that Ofcom had suggested. But it's another possibility that we could see next year if we don't get something like roaming is, you know, someone like Ofcom or the networks trying to make it easier to move between themselves. The incentive is that they can be as easily moved to as away from. So it's still a level playing field. What do you reckon, Ian?
I can see some real sense in that. I mean, I don't think it's too bad, honestly. I don't feel like it's really hampering anything. I think that there are other industries where it's much worse. But yeah, I'm all for the investment of making things easier for customers. And also, I think that means you get better service because people don't want, because, you know, service providers will be worried that customers will be able to leave easily.
Well, for the very last bit of news about phones and mobiles that we wanted to get to for this week, I just wanted to touch on my excitement, which isn't as rude as that just came out, about the number of new, very compelling networks that we've had this year. You know, BT Mobile launched last year, but in January became part of EE. We've more recently had PlusNet launch a very compelling 4G service. We've had Sky Mobile opening up its signups for customers with great deals, and I'm not sure if they do data rollover, but I think they do. Yes, in fact, they do. They have the piggy bank thing where you can roll up for over 3 years. And you've got Virgin Mobile rolling out 4G plans, zero rating Facebook Messenger and WhatsApp. And we talked about that in November in episode 74, if you want to hear a bit more about Virgin's deal. But it just got me very excited this year to look at the number of these smaller networks launching very compelling services. And you signed up to PlusNet, I think, didn't you, Ian?
I did, yes. And I've been pretty happy with it so far. I haven't been able to ascertain whether or not it's slightly capped, you know, speed limited based on my particular use. But I don't have any reason to believe it is. I just haven't spent enough time using it out of my house, to really work out whether or not that's the case. I will do more testing and let everyone know.
Andy, what's your view on some of these launches? Because they've all aimed towards the budget end, and they've all had some unique perks, either rolling over data or inclusive calling plans for family members and things like that. Are any of them tickling your areas again, without sounding too rude?
Value generally is always a good thing, and when 4G just is no longer the pricey premium that it used to be. I remember when EE first launched, and it was you get 500 megabytes of data, and it costs you £1 billion a month, and it was laughable at how expensive. So it's really great to see in a relatively short space of time, only a couple of years really, to see 4G coming down so cheap, and certainly more people, more companies like Sky and PlusNet getting involved, then the more competition there'll be. And the more extras. None of the extras really stand out to me.
Are you kidding? Data rollover isn't exciting to you?
Not really, because I just have enough data that I use without thinking as much as I need to in the month anyway. Like, it doesn't matter because it's more affordable now. So my plan, I get 25 gig of data, and I have no idea how much I use. I don't think it's even close to 20.
Well, let me throw out a little reason why I think this could be interesting, because it relates to a previous story we've talked about. But with 4G becoming much more penetrative into the countryside, and with the idea of being able to roll over data, but then to be able to use it as your broadband connection, if that data rolled over, that would become a very compelling way of accessing the internet from a laptop or a computer.
So you're suggesting that if you know that next month you want to do a lot of gaming, then you will not use so much this month, and you'll save 5 gig and then put that towards a massive frag session next month.
Not really gaming, because gaming doesn't take a great deal of data.
Well, whatever, you know.
That. I mean, in general, the idea of being able to use 4G as your only internet connection in the country.
I agree. I think using 4G as your only internet is brilliant, and that definitely will be the future. But I think that because it is becoming so affordable, you won't need the rollover because you'll just have so much of such a big limit, if not in the 20s or 30s of gigabytes, then just pure unlimited, as it is for fiber broadband now.
All right, let's talk now about a story that got Ian all hot under the shirt.
Ooh!
Exactly. And I remember when you first made that noise. I had to call the police, didn't I? Because I was so, worried about what made you so excited.
Such an unusual noise to hear out of someone who makes a living out of being morose.
Well, exactly. And the police agreed with me on that front. But the reason was 4K this year.
Yes.
We've had a lot of really interesting developments in Britain in the 4K space, whether that's Planet Earth 2 being made in Ultra HD, whether it's Virgin 4K, whether it's Sky Q rolling out more widely. Like, there's a lot of stuff. Streaming, obviously, is a big deal. Like, given that I've basically just said all those things, can I get you to repeat those to me back and explain maybe why I used those examples?
Well, look, I mean, I tell you why you're right and why this year and last year was so significant for 4K. This is the first time we've seen usually the next generation of watching, you know, quality, that kind of stuff from, you know, be it 1080p, HD from standard definition, has been delivered by physical media and often by broadcast networks. And this time, what we've seen is that whole charge has been led by YouTube, Netflix and Amazon Prime Video. That's where the majority of your 4K footage is going to have come from in 2016. Sky has started, I believe, and BT was the first to get going on 4K football. So it's happened and it's going to continue to happen. We've seen the Planet Earth 2 trial where people could watch some footage on their TVs. And that's great and very exciting. But I think it's interesting to see how we've basically realised that the internet is, for a lot of people, again, going back to that thing about people not having good internet access, is becoming even more important that they do, because so much stuff is coming first to the internet, because we can send anything we want over the internet. We don't require an expensive piece of, apart from a computer, we don't require a new TV, a new thing. We can just use what we've got and get access to extremely good quality stuff.
So it's 2017, Andy. I mean, is this the year of 4K going mainstream?
I think so. We've got Sky launching Sky Q. We've got the Virgin boxes. A lot more ways that people can access the content. And that was always the problem last year, that every TV that was launched was 4K, but yet how do you get this? We didn't have 4K discs, and I mean, actually, it's still 4K physical discs. Are they still really?
They still make them, yeah. There are some 4K Blu-ray players out there, yeah.
Yeah,
but they're very expensive, but they're also, I mean, will always be the best quality way of getting 4K.
Yeah, I suppose so. But I think it's very interesting seeing more stuff that's being produced for 4K. Netflix have been doing a big push out, and I just think that's, we're only going to see more of that, and particularly, again, going back to the internet, we're getting faster speeds that allow people to actually have it.
To give you a sort of an anecdote, if you want one, when I worked years and years ago back on Top Gear, I remember the transition to HD, and they were like, we can't do this, it's too expensive, it's like a whole other production. So we'd be basically paying twice as much to make the show. And then I remember when the Grand Tour started on Amazon Prime, there was a Q&A session with Andy Wilman, the producer, and he said, Amazon said to us from the start, this has got to be HDR and it's got to be 4K. Off you go. And, you know, that for them is quite a sea change. It's like, you know, well, we've got to produce this thing in the absolute best quality imaginable, whereas before we'd have just gone for the easy option.
It is interesting to me that the Grand Tour was shot in 4K and it's probably shot in 5K, I'm guessing, but it was certainly put out on Amazon Prime as 4K, but very little was made of the fact that it was available in 4K. Like, it's not really advertised as, you know, here's a great thing to watch in 4K, because it was still relatively difficult to watch it in 4K. The only way I managed it was because my Sony Smart TV, which is 4K, has an Amazon app built in, and I could watch it in 4K through that. But
don't get me started on this, because this is Amazon's big problem, isn't it? Their ability to support hardware is actually absolutely atrocious, and they make a rod for their own back, really, because if you think about the simplicity of Netflix, that's why people like that service, don't they?
Yeah. Well, maybe 2017 will be the year that 4K becomes mainstream. I certainly don't think we're lacking in content that people actually want to watch globally, and certainly in the UK as well. So fingers crossed, I suppose. Well, let's get to one last story that we wanted to talk about. This one comes from Andy, asked, what story got you very excited this year in British tech? And he said,
the Apple will be moving into Battersea Power Station for its new European HQ.
Give me five reasons why.
Okay, one, it's great to see that Apple is moving more heavily into the UK, particularly post-Brexit, when people are despairing that tech firms are going to be moving to Berlin. Also, so that's great news for England, it's great news for London, but it's also great news for Battersea Power Station itself, because this is a truly iconic building. Those four big chimneys, they are part of the protected skyline of London, so you can't get rid of those. And so for, I think it's about over 30 years now, that building has been sitting idle, really, looking pretty and, well, not pretty really, is it, but looking dramatic on the banks of the Thames, but no one's done anything with it. So the idea of having Apple in there doing something cool like Apple does, I mean, we can look at what the plans Apple has for its spaceship campus in California, and only got to look at what it's done with its new Regent Street store or with Covent Garden to kind of see that, well, Apple really cares about the look of its offices and how things are sort of approached aesthetically. And you got to think, well, that's could be really interesting for Battersea. Yeah. I know that's not five, but I've got to the end of my points, and those really are the two main points.
Yeah, I mean, there are bonuses there. I mean, definitely the area that the headquarters being built in is an area that really has been lacking in any kind of good reason for people to go there. You know, it's difficult to get to. There's not a
tube station, and that is one of the factors that's been put in place, that whoever develops a station needs to, needs to develop transport links. I think at one point there was an insistence that they have to put in a new tube stop it. But that would cost many, 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 many millions of pounds, which is why previous companies have pulled out, because they just haven't had the funds to do that.
Well, let's be honest. Like, this isn't Apple that is transforming this site. Apple is leasing huge amounts of it, but it's a different company that's developing it. You know, so there'll be tons of shops around there. Apple will be paying a fortune to do what it's doing, but it's not just Apple in this site. There will be shops, there will be flats. Some of them have already been vouched for by celebrities. There will be a tube station. You know, the Northern Line is going to extend down there. So it's great, but it is certainly, as you say, with Apple's money, with its need to have something much bigger, like, that is clearly a huge impetus to this project being successful.
Absolutely, and Apple having that power there will almost certainly be swaying the direction of some of the design and of the architecture going in, and the facilities that are around the area, because it will be the major tenant, presumably.
Would you like to know my favourite fact about the Battersea Power Station?
Go on, because I wrote a few down as well.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
Ian, do you know what my favourite fact is about the Battersea Power Station?
No, tell me.
It was designed by Sir Giles Gilbert Scott, who also designed the red phone boxes that are oh so famous in London.
It was bought by Alton Towers in the 80s with a view to turning it into a massive indoor theme park.
That would have been amazing.
Would it, though?
No, but it would have been fun to see. Imagine that, a roller coaster going through the ins and outs of Battersea Power Station. Huge waste for the station, because you could achieve the same sort of gravitational effect without the building being around the track, but still.
Yeah, it does seem a bit of a waste. I could imagine turning it into a massive indoor skate park or a trampoline park would be quite fun.
It's a pain in the ass to get to. No one is going to say, okay, I'm going to get three buses and walk for 15 minutes to go trampolining.
I did that when they opened oxygen free jumping in East Acton.
Ian, would you go trampolining in Battersea? You like to bounce. I've seen you bounce.
I do.
Not always on purpose, but I've seen it happen.
The kids have got a trampoline. It's in the back garden. I don't need to go anywhere.
I assume you're too large for that. Because if you jump on it, your son's just going to fly off into the stratosphere.
If I go on it on my own, it's okay. I am technically over the weight limit for it, but it's fine.
You often go solo trampolining in your garden?
No.
No. Probably for the best. I used to have a trampoline.
Well, what a story.
Sorry, that's
that's a great anecdote. Thanks.
We are at the end of the show, and I just thought I would leave it on a high note. And, you know, that's a great way of getting high, bouncing there. Okay, well, that's going to do it for this week's special show. Firstly, thank you very much to Mr. Andrew Hoyle.
Thank you for having me.
And tell people where they can find you on the web of Inter.
You can find me on Twitter with @BatteryHQ, or you can just Google Andrew Hoyle Cena, and I'm sure I'll turn up somewhere.
Ian, it's been a pleasure to be in your virtual presence for another 45 minutes.
Yeah, exactly. Looking forward very much to 2017 together here on this show.
Me too. And that is a great segue for me to remind you that if you would like to have your feelings about the show heard, this is the last week you have to fill in our survey. It would mean the world to us if you could complete it. It's going to close next Sunday. So I think that is the 8th of January at around about midnight London time. So you've got a few more days. There's a link in your MP3 file. There's a link if you go to natelangson.com/podcast. You can find it there. We would be grateful. And here's looking forward to another wonderful year talking about tech with you all on Text Message.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.